This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, Lichen Doesn't Die. Forrest Gander is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, translator, and geologist who lives and breathes those famous words by John Donne. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. In all of his work, Forrest feels for connections to other human beings, to other cultures and languages, and to the natural world. We talked over the phone.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Forrest. This is Helena.
Yeah, good.
Me in my closet in New York. Forrest from a room on the east side of his home in Sonoma County, California. What do you see when you walk out the door?
We're looking right now through a big window at the Sonoma Mountain. It's really beautiful. And in the morning, it's completely covered with fog and it blows off late morning. And there's one sequoia out in front too, which is really nice to look through.
Yeah. I wanted to start with your early passion for geology. Do you remember what stories or processes or facts tickled the poet in you?
You know, all of it in so many different ways. Volcanology seemed like a really exciting field of geology to go into, to look at what was coming out of the belly of the earth. But I was really interested in paleontology also. And then there's also the more conceptual way that it trained me to see things so that, and this is sort of modeled in my poetry, that I'll be moving from large scale to small scale and back a lot. So in looking at geology, you know, you're looking at crystalline structures under microscopes. And you're also looking at large-scale formations where you're reading a history of things that have happened over millions of years. And I have a huge fossil collection.
What's your favorite one?
I have a mastodon tooth, but really I like the Devonian trilobites. I've got a lot of pretty cool trilobites.
What are those?
They're three-lobed underwater creatures, and they ruled the world for a long time.
And what do they look like? What's their closest, like, ancestor? Oh, no, not, what is the word? Progeny.
Yeah, maybe a horseshoe crab. Oh. Most trilobites are smaller than horseshoe crabs, but they sort of look like that. Same sort of general body shape. I do have one really good fossil story. When Meredith came up the stairs,
Meredith was the engineer recording our conversation.
She passed what looks like Monoceratops skull. And okay. So like a Triceratops?
I feel really ashamed that I don't know more
about
this.
Oh, you know your Triceratops? That's that big dinosaur. It's like a huge pig with a armor shield on its head and these three horns that poke out. That's the tripart of the ceratops.
Right.
So this huge creature, and I had taken an old fossil book from the 50s to guide me to an area in Virginia near Lexington where there were good fossils. And I was looking for brachiopods and the sea fossils, which are more common there, and finding them in these rocks. And then suddenly I came across this enormous skull. And I just couldn't contain myself. I thought, well, one, you know, I'd be sending my kid to college on the funds from this, and that I would be in Time magazine. And it didn't occur to me that there weren't many triceratops in Virginia. They're mostly out west. And then when I went to touch it, it felt awfully light for bone. And as I was carrying it back to my car, I knew that something was wrong, even though it was this huge, you know, skull that was as big as half of me. And it turns out that there in Lexington, there's a university, and that they built a natural history museum in the woods far away from the university. And evidently, they were making skulls out of plaster of Paris, and this one didn't turn out completely right. And someone just dumped it down this hill into this fossiliferous area where I found it.
Oh, were you alone when you found this?
I was totally
skull?
Alone. I was going through so many shades of emotion and exhilaration and disappointment. But I've kept it. I've kept it and brought it out
good,
to California with
maybe
me.
If this would have actually been what you thought it was, then maybe you would have stopped writing poetry because you're like, well, you know, that college fund is paid for.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
In January of 2016, Forrest Gander lost his wife and closest artistic companion of 33 years, the poet C.D. Wright, who died unexpectedly in her sleep. The book Forrest wrote in the aftermath is called Be With, a title taken from the dedication page of the last collection CD published while she was still alive, Shell Cross. That dedication reads, "For Forrest, line, lank, and long, be with." I was really blown away by this poem, Madonna del Parto. And I was just wondering if you wanted to read it and if you wanted to introduce it first.
Sure.
It's on page 21.
Thank you. So you know the painting that this comes from. It's an amazing Renaissance painting of the Madonna pregnant and it looks like her ninth month, and so pregnant that her blue robe opens on her belly, so that it looks like almost a waterfall or a crack in the middle of her. My wife and I saw this, saw the painting where it used to be held in a very little chapel. And in writing this book, which is a book that has a lot of grief in it for the death of my wife, and spending a lot of time during a period of grieving when I didn't want to be around people, and being out here in California, I was going into the wilderness a lot. And seeing this coming upon a moment of seeing a waterfall across the forest that came down between two sort of folds of greenery on either side, I thought about the painting, and I also felt filled with emotional force connected to nature and connected to feeling that was very intense. Madonna del Parto. And then smelling it, feeling it before the sound even reaches him, he kneels at cliff's edge and for the first time turns his head toward the now visible falls that gush over a quarter mile of uplifted sheet granite across the valley, and he pauses, lowering his eyes for a moment, unable to withstand the tranquility, vast, unencumbered, terrifying, and primal, that naked river enthroned upon the massive altar, bowed cypresses congregating on both sides of sun-gleaming rock, a rip in the fabric of the ongoing forest, from which rises, as he tries to stand, tottering, half-paralyzed, a shifting rainbow, volatilized by ceaseless explosion.
Thank you. Yeah, that ending, that naked river enthroned upon the massive altar, bowed cypresses congregating, in all that concrete stuff that you described, the trees, the river, the rock, there's also
I get this sense that, you know, you're aware of something sort of beyond the concrete, like a kind of whole, maybe even holy. And I found a quote that you included in another collection you wrote, the Blue Rock Collection, where you quote the French poet Paul Éluard, who says, "There is another world, but it is inside this one."
Well, I love that quote. In geology, we find out that inside the earth are chemolithotropes, these organisms that don't need light, and that their mass probably by far outweighs the mass of life on the surface of the earth. And that's a world inside our world that we don't know about.
Yeah, you know, if human beings have one talent, I think it's taking for granted what surrounds us every day. For instance, the landscape. And so I'm wondering, how do you keep looking and seeing and being open to that non-human centered way of being within?
Well, I think there's lots of ways for that. And I think they're all connected to spirituality, though. I was just taking a walk a couple days ago to look for the ruins of the cabin that a famous California poet, Kenneth Rexroth, lived in and wrote some of his best poems in, which is now in a forest, Samuel Taylor Forest. And there, you're walking along a path next to a creek, and on either side of you are steep banks of ferns, and there's no ruins, in fact, left anymore. And I think we sort of touched on it earlier, that I tend to be looking at particulars and then looking up for context.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, apologies for being yet another person who wants to talk to you about grief. But how do you look up for context when the person that you love dies?
Yeah, that's a very big question. I know that I lost all context then for, you know, I wasn't interested in writing for 2 years. I had trouble, you know, I just had trouble being vertical, and I was waylaid. That's what it does. I lived with someone who is not one moment in our 30 some years together uninteresting. And when you spend so much time with someone, your identity becomes a kind of mutuality. And every memory that I have, I felt like I had lost also in losing the person that I'd shared those memories with.
Yeah.
And I still, it's still a struggle and something that, you know, Kurosawa says, never look away, but I still can't look directly at it.
There's this one poem that you wrote after the mystic St. John of the Cross.
Yeah. I actually stopped reading from this book after the second reading. I didn't want to turn the book into a performance, and I didn't want to be performing my grief.
Mm-hmm.
The first ballad after St. John of the Cross, that was one of the turns in the book, away from just loss and towards feelings of love.
When you said I've stopped reading from the book, do you prefer we don't read this?
No, I could. That's one I could read.
Okay. Perfect. Maybe you can say a little bit more about how you came across him and, you know, your poetics of translation.
Well, translation has long been a part of my literary activity, and I think of it also as a more of a spiritual activity than a transcriptural activity, that you sort of have to disappear from your ego and into such an intense listening that you hear the music of someone else's mind. And then you have to come back with everything you know and try to make that happen in English. But I was interested in the way that St. John of the Cross, through his suffering, looked for a depth of feeling. It's something that I also find in the poetry of Raul Zorita, the great contemporary Chilean poet, who was tortured by Pinochet and who saw so many people who were friends and neighbors disappear. They were chopped into pieces and dropped from helicopters into the mouths of volcanoes and into the sea and into the desert. So the very landscape in Chile is so permeated with the human that they become in some ways indistinguishable. This poem was also thinking about how to get out of pain. And like with Zorita, his work becomes about love.
Yeah. I was reading about, you know, where St. John of the Cross was writing these poems, and he was being tortured in prison as well.
Yeah.
What sort of ideas got him in trouble?
Well, he was a mystic, and mysticism contradicts the kind of dogma that religious institutions often depend upon, which is why I feel drawn to religiosity and the urge to worship, but not towards the kinds of institutions that have such
church.
A terrible history.
Yeah. Do you want to read the poem?
Sure. First ballad, a wreath after St. John of the Cross. In the beginning, the Word was as being, in happiness, infinitely the Word possessed. The same Word being was, said to be beginning. Beginninglessly it went on, a sum caroming through fervid void, for the Word from the outset always was, conceiving, concentrating its consequence, for glory in the Word possessed the being, and all of being's substance it gleaned from the Word, lover in beloved in the other one went on. And that love which entwined them was of the same sum, two voices, one beloved, among two, and in them each one happiness rendered them one lover, a splendor unconfessed, gleaming, as two possess one being, each alone possessed it, each of them, in love, a plenum of the Word, whose being each twined around the other, beyond comprehension, an ineffable knot. Such fervid love entwined the two together, in one voice both possessed, a plenum of the world. The more that love was one, the more of love there was.
Thank you. Yeah, it's wonderful to hear you read it. It's really wonderful, you know, because there's so many white spaces in the text, and I wasn't sure how you would sound that.
I feel like it's calling across, you know, the abyss into another world, making contact, and that rip right down the middle of the poem is the grief that a voice is reaching across.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to, because I think sometimes when you listen to poetry and you hear it only once, it can sometimes be hard to sort of figure out what is going on. So if you don't mind, I would like to go through it a little bit slower. So you open the poem with Yeah, well, as we already talked about, like this sort of mystical, you know, you don't only have it in Christianity, but in Sufism, in Buddhism, you know, like this idea of the world and the word and everything as one, right? There's no separation. In the beginning, the word was as being in happiness, you know, like that oneness is a happy thing, you know?
Yeah.
And there's no beginning that sort of severs it from something else. No, beginning beginninglessly.
Right. It moves from there towards meaning, towards the consequence of the investment in each other, in language, which is how we offer mm-hmm. ourselves to each other. So that always was conceiving, concentrating its consequence. And then the sense of the twining, which we talked about earlier, the way that an identity can be a kind of mutuality. Really, every identity is a mutuality, and every word we use has been used by other people, that we're composed of everyone who came before us and the creatures also, that our identities, even in our DNA, there's the DNA of parasites that long ago became incorporated into our system, so that we're not mm-hmm. even pure as a species. You know, the yeah. Ku Klux Klan, you know, doesn't want to hear about that, but because right. they believe in purity of blood, but it's a complete made-up thing. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. I also love that you use the language almost of the dogma of the Holy Trinity. Only here it's like a holy duality, you know. Two voices, one beloved, one happiness rendered them one lover. I was wondering if, you know, you're reading certain religious texts, but you're reading them almost against their dogmatic grain, right?
I'm finding the religious in the secular. And this poem has been sort of the launching pad for what I'm writing now, which is curiously, I'm writing a lot about lichen. And I've been working with this incredible mycologist, one of the luminaries in the field, whose name is Ann Pringle, who writes a lot for the New York Times. So it turned, you know, when you and I were in high school, we learned that lichen is, you know, a cyanobacteria that gets together with an algae and synergistically becomes something else. But it's way more complicated than that. There are actually more than two things. And then the curious thing is that the two main things that come together give up their former identities. They can't go back and become what they were, because their meeting changes them completely. And then according to Ann Pringle, it looks like we have to rethink our ideas about death, which of course as human beings, our ideas about death are mammal-centered. But it looks like maybe lichen doesn't die. Of course, you can kill it, you can take a blowtorch to it, but under circumstances where it has enough moisture, lichen may not die. And the thought of coming together, as in this poem, and of being completely transformed into something else that maybe doesn't die, seems to me a beautiful metaphor for intimacy. Such fervid love entwined the two together. In one voice both possessed a plenum of the world. The more that love was one, the more of love there was.
You know, in your, you know, if there's one thing that all human beings have in common since the dawn of time. It's that the people they love die.
Mm-hmm.
And that must be manifest in language, in the worldview that is present in a word or in a way of seeing. Have you found a way that has been helpful to you to deal with living with that?
Mm-hmm. It's a really good question. That everyone experiencing grief, that thing that Wallace Stevens says, you know, death is the mother of beauty. It's if we lived forever, then it wouldn't, the world and what we see wouldn't be nearly so poignant as knowing that we're going to depart from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one of the books that I co-translated with Kent Johnson, of a Bolivian poet named Jaime Sáenz, he's very interested in Aymara language and culture. And the Aymara is the majority indigenous population of Bolivia.
Uh-huh.
And in Aymara culture, there's the feeling that death is a very permeable boundary that people can cross back and forth through. The language was denied me for the first 2 years, and then it kind of just gushed forth. It was almost like a sickness that came out of me as language. People said I was better afterwards. I think that when we do find a way to articulate feeling, even the most unspeakable feeling, rage or grief, that that language is one way of understanding it that keeps us from not completely understanding, but for working towards an understanding that keeps our rage from just becoming violence, or keeps grief from becoming suicide.
Mm. Yeah. That's interesting, because, you know, language is so, I don't know if you feel this, but I feel like it's so frustrating too, right? Because it doesn't ever say enough.
Right. It's always failing. It's always failing.
Yeah.
It always fails. And yet, it's completely worth the effort. Because if we didn't make the effort, we wouldn't glean what we do glean.
Forrest Gander is the author of over 10 collections of poetry, with titles like Core Samples from the World, The Blue Rock Collection, Torn Awake, and his latest, which won the Pulitzer, Be With. The last project C.D. Wright worked on was a poetic, anthropological, historical, and scientific ode to the beech tree, Casting Deep Shade, and was published posthumously by Copper Canyon Press. You can find more about both poets on the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode was by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.